weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 411 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. As always, thanks so very much for listening. This week I have a great conversation with Frank Gogol, a creator we're going to hear a lot more from in the future. He's already made two wonderful comics. The first is called Grief, and it's something of an anthology in which he's written all the stories in it, and it deals, of course, with the subject of grief, and various artists portray the individual stories. Then recently he came out with a miniseries called Dead End Kids. It's a murder mystery, but it also deals with fascinating characters. Some teenagers who are on the verge of growing up and have to deal with a very difficult situation. We talk about how Frank got into the comics business, as well as what we can expect from him in the future. He's got a sale coming, which he talks about, that enables you to get all these good creations. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Great to welcome to the podcast Frank Gogol, the creator of an anthology called Grief, as well as a miniseries from Source Point Press called Dead End Kids. How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk with you. I got to meet you at Baltimore Comic Con recently, and that's where I got picked up Dead End Kids. I already had Grief, which I really liked, and so there's all kinds of good stuff to talk about. Why don't you talk about, you know, your experience as a writer, you know, because I understand you worked with Comics Experience, which I interviewed Andy a while back, and I've always been interested to talk with somebody who actually went through the process as to what you thought of it and, you know, how you came out of it different than when you went in.
Oh, yeah, I can definitely speak to that. There's like a long, there's a, like a long version of the answer, and then there's the short version of the answer. I'll try to do something in the middle. Okay. First and foremost, like, let me just like be like really direct and say, like, Comics Experience is the reason I'm able to write comics. There is a lot of stuff in my life that like gave me the tools and the skills, and like I tried. Like, I started trying to make comics when I was 18 and had a lot of false starts, and I really started trying when I graduated college in 2010, so about 10 years ago. And so many false starts, so much not knowing what to do. And then like I took that intro to comic book writing with Andy in early 2016, I think. I can't even remember the years anymore, but it was just like the second that class was over, it was like something unlocked in me, and like I have not stopped making comics since. Like, I walked out of that class with a short story called Embrace, which is the last story in Grief. And then between that April and the following December, so about 8 months, I wrote 9 more stories, and those 10 stories ended up becoming Grief. And since then, I've written a bunch of one-shots, a bunch of miniseries. Some of it's been published. Some of it's in the pipeline. And, like, it really, for me, that taking that class with Andy was very much a milestone. And you mentioned that, like, you wanted to talk to somebody who's sort of taken the class with Andy and has done the Comics Experience. And it's always sort of wild to me that Comics Experience flies so under the radar still. Some of like the biggest names in comics like have come out of Comics Experience in the last 10 years. He doesn't talk about it much, and I've never met him in person, so I don't know how he feels about it. But Nick Spencer is a Comics Experience alum, and he's writing Spider-Man right now. Mm-hmm. I know that Dan Slott used to teach at Comics Experience way back in the day. Like, we're talking maybe between 10 and 15 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. Who else? Ram V, who just got announced as the writer of Justice League Dark after James Tynion, is a Comics Experience alum. I mean, like, there's a lot of them out there, and like every year there's a few more. And, you know, I hope that these guys start talking about it more, but I know that I definitely will sing its praises till the day I die, because I wouldn't be on this podcast with you without it.
How long did you go through there? I mean, is it like a year or 6 months? How do you do it?
So it's set up more similarly to a like an online course. It's online education. So it's a video conferencing. It's small class sizes. I think the biggest class I've ever had was 12 people, including myself, with one instructor. And it's largely I've had Andy Schmidt, I've had Fred Van Lente, I've had Paul Aller, who has done a lot of Ninja Turtles, as instructors. And it's video conferencing through GoToMeeting. So we see Paul or Andy or Fred's face on the screen. They're sort of lecturing us in real time. And then there's a chat. The classes tend to run anywhere from 4 to 7 weeks, depending on the class. Yeah, what the curriculum for the class is. I am currently taking, I'm going to get this wrong, I think my 5th or 6th class with Comics Experience right now. It's a freelance writing sort of boot camp with Paul Aller, sort of that's sort of where I want my career to go next, is to move into to sort of writing other people's IP and trying to build a freelance career. So that was a class that I thought would be helpful. But I've taken the intro to writing class. I've taken a couple of the advanced writing classes. There's a dialogue class with Fred coming up at the beginning of the year that I'm thinking of taking. So like, it's just, I guess to answer your question, the classes are about 6 weeks.
Okay. Well, that's interesting, because you're still taking classes even though you've not been published. A lot of people feel once they get published and they know what they need to know and then go on, but apparently there's still some things you're wanting to pick up.
Yeah, well, I mean, so one of the biggest complaints that I've heard from most of the veteran comic book creators I know, and like the mid-level guys, like Justin Jordan's a buddy of mine, Paul is a buddy of mine, and some of the other guys who are, you know, now broken into Marvel, like one of their biggest complaints, and they're a little bit older than me, was that they didn't have like any sort of like focused resources available to them. Like a lot of guys had to, you know, scrounge forums to find artists. They had to, you know, read books that had some of the answers they're looking for and not others. And I live in an age where we have Comics Experience and I can hop on a video conference and learn in person from people who are actually doing it right now and ask them questions. And like, I mean, that's an invaluable resource. These classes could cost $10,000 and I would probably still take them. Like, that's a lot of money, but like, I mean, just to stress how really amazing it is that this kind of thing exists. And again, like, it's wild to me how under the radar it has flown. You know, obviously it's growing every year and it's producing, you know, superstars at this point. But, you know, I'm surprised it's not like every would-be writer's first choice.
Because I talked to Andy, he actually listens to this podcast, which surprised me. Whenever somebody actually listens and they tell me, I'm always surprised.
If I've said anything bad about Andy, edit that out.
Well, you haven't, so we don't have to do that.
Andy is a great instructor, and honestly, I do consider him a mentor, and honestly, a not a peer or a friend at this point, but I do find that Andy and I are very friendly these days. We shared a hotel earlier this year in Houston for Comic Palooza, and like, you know, I've been out to eat with him a bunch of times, and we talk regularly, and I try to do stuff for Comics Experience when I can. And Andy's 100%, like I said, taking that class with him unlocked all of this for me. So like, I'm incredibly indebted to Andy, and everyone who's listening to this who wants to make comics needs to go take his class. Like, it's that simple.
It's kind of interesting because you touched on a thing or two. I edit an independent comic, and the way that the writer put everything together was he did just what you said. He went out on Facebook and went through different groups looking for like art people and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, what started end up for us, it worked really well when we went to like conventions and we ended up meeting other people. We started to meet people that gave us all kinds of connections. And you know, we've moved so far because we come into these people just like you are with Andy. We are with several other people that we've come across along the way. And it's an amazing experience. I highly recommend, well, you recommend the Comics Experience. I would recommend going to conventions.
So when I started in comics, I think that this is fairly typical of a lot of people who get started. I didn't really know what to do. I knew that networking was part of it, but I didn't know how to network. I didn't know sort of where to go. I didn't know sort of the best practices. I didn't know the sort of do nots of it all. And one of the benefits of Comics Experience is they have a creators workshop forum. And essentially what that is it's like any other forum. It's a private forum that you log into and you can post topics and questions and the community is large and robust enough, and there are pros involved too. Paul's on there, Fred's on there, Riley Brown, who's done a bunch of Deadpool art for Marvel, is on there. Bon Ali Magno is on there now. He used to edit at Harris Comics and then was talent scout at Marvel. Like, I mean, there's a lot of opinions and like a wealth of information in this one spot. So like, I was able to go in there and sort of just ask, hey, for those of you who've been doing this, what should I do? How do I go about networking? Like, what are the best practices? And I was able to sort of get that very distilled information very quickly. And then in April 2018, I went to C2E2 in Chicago for what I consider like my first professional convention, like to do networking and to like, you know, scout publishers and stuff like that. And I felt like I walked in there prepared because I had this incredible resource to dig into before I went and wasted a bunch of money and time not knowing what to do.
That sounds great, because a lot of times people go to conventions and we're kind of like we're trying desperately to find what we should be doing.
Yeah.
And most of the time it's just us talking to each other. That's when we come across stuff and we meet people.
It's not even most of it. I think that's all of it. Like, honestly, like I do my best networking when I'm trying to make friends rather than when I'm trying to do business. And like, it's that simple. Because like an editor, all editors know that writers and artists want work, but like, if you go sniffing up the tree, you know, and only walk in trying to talk about business, like that's not like a unique or interesting experience for them. Like, they're not going to remember it, and they're not going to think favorably of it. this is a sort of good and bad example from my own history. I had met Heather Antos a few times over the last couple of years, and I don't really get like nerves about meeting people, and I sort of just kind of stand up and do it. But I was always kind of nervous about Heather because I respect her work so much. And she is, I think, rightfully, you know, very sort of a little bit harder to approach than some other people, because she's had such a rough time of it over the years. And I think she's got to have those sort of stone walls up a little bit. And I'd sort of unsuccessfully met her a few times and very unmemorably, and like didn't even get across the finish line. And then in Boston at Boston Comic Con earlier this year, or Fan Expo Boston, Andy had set up a dinner after hours, and we all went out to eat. And I got to sit next to her, and like I actually got to talk to her, and like, you know, have like genuine conversation with her. And now, you know, she recognizes me when I come by, and like, you know. Yeah, it's more friendly, and like there's some social media interaction. Like, it's just about, you know, those baby steps and not trying to do too much, or, you know, just look at people as opportunities. Like, networking really is about just meeting people. And then for all I know, Heather could hate me. Like, I don't know. Who knows?
Oh, I doubt that.
I think the point stands, like, you know, that there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And I learned right way from comics experience, and then by actually getting out and doing it.
Cool. Well, I would highly recommend that too, because that's how, you know, my friend and I did it. We dove in. We went to the first convention we ever went to, was Heroes, and we failed miserably.
That's a tough one too. Like, Heroes, it's a sort of a medium show, but it's got a lot of like great creators, and like I've been twice, and like I like that show a lot. Mm-hmm. I've never been like in my professional career, and I'm hoping to go this year. Mm-hmm. That's the other part of it. Like, a lot of people focus on like figuring out what to do right, but you can learn from failure too. Like, you go and you do it wrong, and then you know what not to do. I mean, that's the harder way to do what I did, but you know, it works just as well, right?
Yep, because what we did is we were at Heroes, and the next week we were at Florida Supercon. We had picked up so much of what we were doing wrong at Heroes by the time we only had a few days, and we got all this stuff totally changed, and we did 10 times better at Florida Supercon than we did just the week before. So we learned a lot. You're right. Sometimes failure is not a bad thing. We can see what didn't work, and we left that.
And so, having the agility and sort of wits about you to really quickly identify what went wrong and course adjust, like that's priceless right there. I work in at a startup, and there's only 8 of us, and like we deal with millions and millions of dollars worth of, you know, product. And like not being able to like course change very quickly and realize what's not working could be like detrimental. Like it could mean the end of the company like tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So like that's something that's very valuable in all aspects of my life. And it's like if people can develop that skill and like those critical thinking skills, like there's no price you could put on being able to do that.
So to get into Comics Experience, do they go to like the website, comicsexperience.com? Is that where they go to get started?
Yeah. Yeah, just Comics Experience, not to be confused with the Comics Experience comic book shop here in San Francisco. It's Andy's school is COMICS, not X. And then, yeah, there's just up in the top tab somewhere, there's like a course listings. And it'll tell you all the classes that are coming up, when they'll be, what the cost is. The cost is not insignificant, but it is not something that is wildly overpriced for the value you get. They tend to be somewhere between $400 and $700, depending on the number of weeks, the content of the class. And that's priced pretty similarly, just a little bit below what it would cost to do one class for a semester out of college, you know, 3 credits or 5 credits or whatever it is. And if you do the math, like 6 classes at 2 hours a piece is 12 hours of basically what is 1 on 12 time with people who have all the answers you're looking for. It works out to be about $50 an hour. Hmm. Like that is nothing. That editors cost more than that.
Yeah, that's true. So let's dive into grief then. You said you wrote one of the stories and then it got turned into grief. Do you want to talk about that evolution? How did that happen?
Yeah. So like I said, I took the class with Andy in April 2016, and I wrote in that class a story called Embrace, which is sort of a slice of life, little drama story about a father and his sort of daily struggle with having an autistic son and sort of like – yeah, how they sort of learn to just sort of deal and move forward and take it one day at a time. It actually is one of, I think people to this day still say it's like their favorite thing I've ever written, which is great praise, but it's also like, come on, it's the first thing I ever wrote. I want to be able to do better. But I wrote that and I was pretty gung-ho on like making the momentum from the class like last for me, because I knew that like I had so many false starts, like, and after I spent what is not a significant amount of money to take this class, I wanted to make sure that I kept going, which is part of the reason the cost matters to me. When you pay for something, you have more value in it because you know the value of a dollar. If something's free, you don't care about it necessarily as much. but so I had the script. It was professionally edited at this point because Andy had worked through it with me. So I had an artist, a colorist, and a letterer lined up waiting for the finished script. And as soon as I had it and I had the okay from Andy that it was that it was good, I got it out there. And the artist was Nanette Savitikainen, who anyone who's familiar with my work would recognize his work from Dead End Kids. he drew the interiors for Dead End Kids. He did one of the variant covers. He also did about half the stories in Grief. And then on colors, we had Esther Pimentel, who did some stuff for Grief with me, and is doing some stuff for, I think, Oni now, maybe. One of the bigger publishers she's coloring for. And the letterer is Sean Reinhardt, who is another Comics Experience member who I connected with through the forums, and has been pretty much my letter on everything I've ever done, save for a couple of pages of sort of one-off little short stories. Sean's actually working with me on my new book. He did Dead End Kids with me. He did all of Grief. So that's another reason why, Comics Experience is super important, because it's networking. So I got the finished pages for Grief back maybe 10 days later, 2 weeks at the most. And I just remember sort of the high I got opening that email and finished pages, like just watching it come to life stage by stage, thumbnails and pencils and inks and colors and letters and the final packaged pages. Like, I keep using this bad analogy and I need to think of a better one, because this is not super appropriate, but it was kind of like doing crack, which I would know nothing about having not done crack, but it was an extremely addicting moment that I can recognize, like a huge milestone in my life, where I was like, I am pretty good at this. Like, I'm not great, I'm not amazing, I'm not gonna break the diamond pre-order codes with this short story, but I did a good fucking job on this, and I can do better and I can do more. And I honestly, since that day, I have not stopped. Like I said, between that was probably about the end of April and December of that year, I wrote 9 more stories. At some point in the middle, I sort of took 5 or 6 of the stories that had been produced, sort of laid them out on my office floor and was moving them around a bunch, trying to figure out sort of what the next thing to write is. So I'd done some genre stories. I'd done different sort of kinds of characters. And I was just sort of looking for the next thing, trying to figure out how to develop the next muscle. Was it going to be a sci-fi story? Was it going to be a horror story, time travel story? What was it going to be? And as I was sort of shifting these printed out pages around in real space, I started to realize that they very loosely fit with the 5 stages of grief, sort of a framing device for getting through grief, I'm a little bit of an OCD kind of person. I like when there are frameworks and I can sort of identify things in a sort of systematic way. That's how my brain works. And when I read Fallen Son, the Captain America miniseries that followed Civil War in 2007, and Jeff Loeb sort of did these 5 one-shots that was each one of the 5 stages of grief, like, it really resonated with me and stuck with me. And honestly, sort of probably got ingrained a little bit in my storytelling. There's like some very definitive elements. There's a lot of Joss Whedon there. There's a lot of early Stan Lee. I like to torture my characters. I like to talk about sort of topics that I think matter and wrap them in genre stories. So once I sort of made that connection that they were filling out these 5 stages, I sort of got a little more strategic about it and sort of plotted out what I would need to sort of get 2 stories for each of the 5 stages and end up with, 10 stories representing the spectrum in a lot of different ways. And that sort of became grief. I got an amazing cover digitally painted by Danny Martins, who's this incredible painter down in Brazil. That's the cover everyone knows and loves, and I'm going to ruin with the second printing. And then I wrote an essay for the back, sort of tying it all together, explaining why I wanted to talk about these things, why it mattered to me. Andy did a nice little write-up for the front of the book. Actually, that came later. Mm-hmm. Scratch that for now. January of 2017 rolled around, and I had this finished portfolio, anthology, whatever it was, and I had spent a lot of money to make it. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we don't talk about enough in comics is comics are super expensive to make. I would love not to pay $4 for a comic, but I know like how much it costs to make a comic, and it makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I decided to put Grief together as a digital-only Kickstarter, sort of, low overhead, without shipping and sort of, I don't think I was sort of ready for an operation that big. And I took it to Kickstarter. I made I made the campaign and I planned it out, and I set like a pretty low goal. It was like $1,500, just to see if I could recoup some of the money and then sort of invest it in the next project. And then the response to the Kickstarter was pretty wild. Like, We funded the project in under 10 hours on the first day.
Wow.
Yeah. And like, that is specifically wild to me just because of the format. Like, people generally don't like digital comics. They generally don't like comics from creators they've never heard of. Like, it was sort of this weird perfect storm that, like, just the right people found out about it. We had a lot of people who just dug, like, the idea of the book and like pledged for no reward. So they essentially just gave me money. I think the campaign ran for 30 days or 28 days. And when we finished up, we were closing in on $4,000 somewhere in that range. So like it did incredibly well, like blew the doors off, like beyond my wildest expectations. Yeah. And so while that was on Kickstarter in April, I mentioned I went to C2E2 that year and started sort of my professional networking. I didn't know this at the time, and this became relevant later. At that same C2E2, Andy was meeting with a guy named Travis McIntyre, who is the editor-in-chief of SourcePoint Press.
Right.
Rewinding a little bit, Comics Experience at one time had a co-publishing deal with IDW. Mm-hmm. They did, I think, one wave of books. It was 4 books. One was Gutter Magic, which is now at SourcePoint Press. One was Tet by Paul Aller. One was called Drones. I forget the creative team for that, and I cannot ever remember the fourth book. I don't know. But essentially, the agreement was that Comics Experience would be a talent pipeline to generate new creator-owned titles at IDW. Mm-hmm. And the line was pretty fairly successful. Like, you know, it didn't you know, blow up the charts or anything, but like they sold pretty well for creator-owned books. Mm-hmm. From unpublished previous authors. But at some point after the agreement happened, IDW kind of fell in hard times, and they were restructuring a bunch, and they were losing money every quarter. And that led to them sort of cutting all of the supplemental lines, including the Comic Experience line. Mm. So Andy was at C2E2 in 2017 to talk to publishers about reviving a publishing line of some kind, sort of a partnership, talent pipeline for new creators, to get an opportunity to be published. Before that was in place, Andy was planning to do sort of a digital-only Comics Experience branded Comixology publishing line. And Grief was actually one of the first books accepted to that.
Hmm.
He did an open submission on the forums for people who had developed projects in or around Comics Experience in some way. And I said, yeah, why not? And it got accepted. Then Andy was having these conversations that at the time I didn't know about. What ended up happening was that Andy and Travis came to an agreement about producing a co-published line. That was that. We'll flash forward to October of 2018. I was at New York Comic Con, and I was, you know, on my networking grind. Mm-hmm. Meet publishers and other creators, and I walked up to the Source Point table. I'd met them at a couple shows before, but Travis had never been there. And I wanted to introduce myself, and I went up and I introduced myself, and we got talking. He's a pretty personable guy, and it's pretty easy to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And about midway through the conversation, you've met Travis, but for the listeners, he kind of looks like Tormund from Game of Thrones. He's fairly broad, a little chubby, very chubby. Has big. Big wild red beard, mm-hmm. wild red hair, and he's just kind of like a little gruff, but he's big softy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, halfway through this conversation at New York Comic Con, he stops me and says, "What's your name again?" I was like, "Oh, it's Frank Gogol." It's like, "Oh yeah, I just read your book, Grief." I was like, I think you gotta be you must be mistaken. I didn't submit anything." He's like, "It's Grief, right?" It was like, "Yeah." So yeah, we're gonna publish it. So I'm standing in New York Comic Con. It's Saturday. It's like 2:00, and there's just thousands of people around me, and I'm sitting there like having heart palpitations. I think I'm hallucinating, honestly. Like, I think that the pressure of comics as a career just cracked me, and I just imagined that whole thing. And like, I didn't in any way, shape, or form like follow up to like confirm what he had said. We just continued the conversation and like tried to exist. What happened is, like I said, I didn't know 6 months earlier, Andy and Travis had come to this agreement about a publishing line, and without telling me, as a favor, not as like a behind my back thing, Andy submitted Grief as one of the first wave books for the Comics Experience Source Point Press co-branded publishing line, and they accepted it. And then that following April, April's kind of my month. I like to do things in April. In April 2018, I was at C2E2 a year after starting networking with a printed book, standing at a booth with a publisher selling that book. Like, I mean, like, as far as comic careers go, like, I got off pretty easy, like getting my start. But honestly, it speaks volumes to two things. One, hard work. Like, I really did bust my ass behind the scenes, making that Kickstarter happen, making Grief happen, getting the most out of the Comics Experience class, networking. And then the other thing is networking. Like, because I knew Andy, I had this opportunity in front of me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I always say connections.
Yeah. Well, I mean, more than ever, like, your ability to have opportunities is wholly dependent on who you know. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't know anyone, no one can give you an opportunity.
Right.
And like, that's, again, you shouldn't just be knowing people so you can get stuff from them, but it doesn't hurt. Like, earlier this year, I'm a big fan of Matt Rosenberg's work. I love Four Kids Walking to a Bank. I loved what he did with Hawkeye and Winter Soldier in the Tales of Suspense book last year. Mm-hmm. And I'd met him a couple times, but not really, anything substantial. But at Boston Comic Con, Fan Expo Boston, I sort of got talking to him at the bar one night. And it was really like just a casual conversation. And I was telling him about Dead End Kids, and like at that point it had sort of blown up a bunch and sold out a couple of print runs. And he was like, "Oh yeah, I remember what that's like from Four Kids walking to a bank." And then he was telling me, Four Kids was sort of his calling card that got him to be able to pitch to Marvel. Mm-hmm. And so at some point during that conversation, he looked across the bar and said, "That guy over there is Ricky Purdon. He's the one of the talent coordinators and scouts for Marvel. You should hit him up." And I was like, "Oh, that's really nice of you, but he doesn't want to talk to me." But I'm a big believer in taking chances. So a little while after the show, like maybe a week, I reached out to Ricky on Twitter and sent him a DM. And I said, "Hey, I didn't get a chance to introduce myself in Boston, but we were at the bar with Matt Rosenberg." And he said, I should reach out. And Ricky was like super, super responsive, asked me for samples. How many people can say they've submitted samples to Marvel like upon request? Nothing's come of it yet. I don't expect anything to come of it, but it's still a pretty cool thing that was a benefit of me just having a conversation with somebody and not expecting anything,
It's interesting you bring up the Matthew Rosenberg stuff, because his book about kids, there's some similarities between, his books and your book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the books that I was reading while I was writing it for that. He did such a good job. It's interesting. I'm actually rereading it. It hasn't been officially announced yet, but I've been talking about it. I'm going to do a Dead End Kids 2 next year.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. The response was big enough for the publisher, Sourcepoint Apprentice, asked me to do another one. And I thought about it for a little while, and I wasn't going to do it, but then the right story hit me. And there's an element of Four Kids Walk Into a Bank that is really a big element in Dead End Kids too. So I've been sort of rereading some of those issues and studying them and sort of trying to pull out the stuff that worked and replicate it and do my own version of it. So exclusive.
Oh, very cool. Well, I love the book. I picked up Dead End Kids at Baltimore, where I saw you, and I got a chance to sit down and read it. Now, I didn't have to wait between them like people do when they buy them monthly. Mm-hmm. I got to read the whole thing straight through, and I just was really, really, really enamored with the whole thing. In an era where there's so many superhero books out there, and there's just so much, it's all fantasy and all stuff like that, to actually read something that was very strongly anchored in reality, to me, was really an enjoyable change of pace, I have to say. I really loved the various characters and who they were and their experiences. And I know that some of those experiences are probably, gleaned somehow from your lifetime as well. But it's just, the great thing about it, one of the things that I really enjoyed, and as being a geek person, I could relate to this, is that, for the longest time I was a Star Trek fan, and I could never find anybody else that would like Star Trek. My brother and I would. We went to this club meeting one time in the Washington, D.C. area, and suddenly here was this peer group, and we went to conventions together, and we did all this stuff together. You'd talk in there, one of the quotes you say, which I really enjoyed, was that somehow I can't quote it exactly, but it was like all these kids that are sort of not quite on the straight and narrow, shall we say, they come together and they actually heal each other as a result of that. And to this day, we still go to conventions and we still hang out together and we talk to each other about that. And I really related to that in the story because of that. Here were these kids that were kind of, they felt, separate from everybody else. But when they got together, they could, relate to each other. They had like a little clubhouse where they went to talk about stuff. And even though life hits them really hard at points, and I don't know if I want to spoil any of that, there are really good, their relationship to it. There's a phrase that they use a lot. It's what we do. Mm-hmm. And I love that phrase because I thought that if you've ever been a part of a group that's not, you're not a jock, you're not in the norm, the mainstream, you're in this little group that floats outside, you get to know that. You have each other's back kind of set up. And that was one of the things about that Dead End Kids series that I really liked. I really enjoyed that. And it doesn't end up well for everybody, shall we say. But it was such a real life experience, you know. In Batman, he has to come back so that the next issue, some other writer can pick him up where he's supposed to be and then take him and return him back to where he was. You don't have to do that in these books, and that, I think, makes it a really gripping bit of storytelling.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Batman. So one of the ways that I found my way into comics was I had a pretty not great home life growing up. Like, I don't want to get too much into it just, you know, because there's a lot to talk about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for, you know, all intents and purposes, it wasn't great. Mm-hmm. And that's how I found comics, sort of as escapism, as like so many people do. Mm-hmm. And I grew up reading Spider-Man and Batman and Superman. And sort of what I found was, as much as I liked the characters and I love science fiction and fantasy, like, it was very hard for me to relate to the characters, just because of the stuff they went through was so different than what I went through. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Batman's a billionaire. He, like, it doesn't, like, no matter what problems he has, he's never going to have, like, problems the same way I do. And Superman is, like, literally perfect. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, so, like, when I started, I looked to those comics for escapism, but I also looked to them for sort of answers and to be consoled and to sort of weirdly to be told that it would be okay. And I never got that. Hmm. So when I started writing my own comics, one of the first sort of edicts I set down for myself, sort of for my personal style, for lack of a better word, is that before, you know, I worried about any sci-fi bullshit or monsters, that I would tell a human story about something that mattered. And like, that's so ingrained in the DNA of grief. That's why I made my very first story. I ever wrote a straight drama, because I wanted to make sure it was about the characters and not world building and the different kinds of monsters and different high concepts. Like, I really wanted to be able to tell good character stories about shit that mattered to me. And that's true of every story in grief. Embrace, the first story in the collection, is called Cassandra. It's about a mentally ill woman who sees aliens. There's a story in there about a recovering drug addict who used to get superpowers when he did cocaine, but also the story is about his relationship with his mother. Dead in Kids is, it's a crime. It's a murder, but at the core of it, it's still like a drama. It's about these characters and how they interact and what they go through together. And then the mystery for me, like, who killed Ben is so unessential to anything going on. So, like, yeah, there's mystery and there's some investigation and there's a surprise about who the killer is, maybe. But, like, that was all secondary or even tertiary to me. Like, I mean, I am so much more interested in the way characters interact and what they go through and representing sort of underrepresented aspects of the way we live, like, you know, what it's like to be a recovering drug addict or to deal face first with a mental illness or have a bad relationship with your father. And that's true of my work going forward. Dead End Kids 2 is going to be a very different book, but at the core, it's going to be about kids who are going through shit, and the problems will be very real, and it'll it's almost going to be an antithesis to the first volume, and people will see that when it comes out. My next book that's coming out in the early summer next year, No Heroine, is essentially Buffy meets X-23. If they were a recovering heroin addict whose only goal in life is to just, you know, get back in her mom's good graces so she can go back home. Like, yeah, there are vampires and there are werewolves and there are all kinds of fucking monsters and problems. But, like, at the core of the book, it's about this young woman trying to repair her relationships. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, that, those are the kinds of stories I really like. Like, a lot of people like to knock Lost because of the way it ended. And I have some opinions about why they're wrong. And that doesn't matter. The reason Lost worked is because it focused so strongly on the characters. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, there's some really good, you know, mysteries and placement of, like, story elements and stuff, but at the core, like, it was about these group of people, how they interacted and, like, who they were and who they're becoming. And the same thing's true of, like my favorite show of all time is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm. Which is why I wanted to write No Heroine, sort of as my version of Buffy. And it's just, you know, it's a character driven story. It's high school is a horror movie, but, like, the problems are real problems. It's not, you know, most horror movies are just, you know, group of kids get killed, the kids aren't interesting, you don't care. When people died in Buffy, like, it mattered.
Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you something real quickly. I had the same Star Trek group I mentioned earlier. There was a guy who grew up in the inner city, and the rest of us grew up in the suburbs. And whenever we would watch, like, The Wire, I would have to ask him, what's that? What are they referring to? What does that mean? And then when he would watch Buffy, he would say, what are they doing? And I would say, well, they're going to do this, and they're going to do this. We would explain to each other each other's culture with that. So it's kind of funny. I'm going to be fascinated to read your take on Buffy and how you view it and stuff. That's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, I hope people are excited about it, like, when it gets announced and they start to see preview pages and whatnot. Like, it's going to be a very cool book. It's, again, at its core, it's going to be, you know, a book about something that matters to me, which is, you know, what it's like to be a recovering drug addict, and like what that journey is. I think that for good and bad reasons, like, people who are recovering or who have drug problems have a bad reputation, and there's not a lot of sympathy toward them and what they're going through. And like, I've seen it firsthand in my life a bunch of different times. My mom had problems with drugs when I was growing up. My best friend and my cousin, who some of the characters in Dead and Kids is based on, Tom, has been basically in a cycle of relapse and being clean since we were 15, so half of his life. And like, just watching, like, the struggles of what these people go through, and, like, you know, they're not bad people. They're in a bad situation, one that's of their own making. And at this point, it's not necessarily in their control, and they're just trying their fucking hardest. Like, and that's really what's at the core of No Heroine. It's obviously a pun. She's trying to be a hero, and she's really bad at it, so she's no heroine. But also, she doesn't do drugs anymore. But at the same time, like, I also wanted to flex some other muscles. So there's a little bit of a sort of suburban fantasy element to it, with, you know, vampires and werewolves, sort of, I don't know if fantasy is the right word, but magic, spirit,
supernatural.
Supernatural, that's the one. It's got a very strong punk rock ness to it. I grew up on punk music and very much like a grinder and gorilla kind of person. So I wanted to get some of that into a book for once. And it's cool. There's a little more action than is in some other books, and like, it was fun writing these action scenes. The artist on the book is Chris Madd, who Chris is from New Jersey, like me. We used to share a comic shop, and that's how we met. And we sort of grew up in the same area, about 20 years apart. Chris is quite a bit older than me, but Chris has had some of his own struggles with drugs in the past. And we both sort of went to the same high school and like, both have a love of Buffy. His daughter, Shauna, is coloring the book, and she has a love of Buffy too. So like, there's just a lot of love for the source material and the inspiration. Now I'm like, great team. Sean's back on letters. The first issue is about to go get lettered now. We're talking in December. The book's due out sometime in June or July. It's just coming together awesomely. And like, it's just, this one's been in the works since before Dead End Kids got started being written, you know, last May. So like, it's exciting to see it finally taking off and to be able to start talking about it a little bit.
That's cool, because I'm looking forward to it, because every one thing of yours that I've read, I've really enjoyed, and I really think it's different to me. And a variety is a big deal to me. I can read Batman and Superman and the X-Men and all that stuff, and I'll enjoy it, but I want to see something else. I don't want to necessarily see the same stuff. And so to read these stories that are very different, you know, honestly, the experiences are different for me. I grew up in a very but it was different from what you went through. And so for me to read these things, I begin to understand some of those things. I get to see those experiences. And I began to say, okay, that's what that was like. Because I never could quite get it. You know, why do people do what they do? And your books give some beginning of knowledge to me, which I really appreciate, because there are so many things and so many experiences that people have that were different from each other. If we can start to understand a little bit of what's going on with other people, I think we'd be better off. And that's why I like those books so much. I really came away with an idea. I said, okay, I get that now. I begin to see what this is all about. And I think that's really cool that you're doing that. And I really like it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I think one of my biggest weaknesses as a writer is that I don't do necessarily a ton of world building. My scripts are fairly plain, like they're pretty sparse. Like I don't have long panel descriptions for the artist to work on, and that's a lot of it is because I'm lazy. But the other reason is because I like to give the artists room to flex their muscles and do their interpretation of it and make it a true collaboration. And yeah, depending on who I'm working with, I'll give more or less. But generally speaking, I don't add a whole lot into my scripts that isn't like the character arcs and the plots. Dead End Kids, honestly, I want to give so much of the credit to Nanad, who drew and colored the book, because like there's tons of references in there, like posters in the bedrooms and in the clubhouse and just little things. I'm still noticing things that he added in there that weren't in the script. Like, and so much of it is additive. And like a lot of the praise for the book was like, you know, that it really balanced nostalgia. Like some of these things can be like, boom, 90s. Like, look how 90s we are. And like, you know, you lose the story and it's not that great. And it's just essentially an Easter egg hunt. But Nanad is just, he struck exactly the right balance. He knew the right sort of things to reference. Nanad is also a little bit older than me. I want to say he's in his late 30s or early 40s. I've not ever met him. He's in Serbia. But I know he's got a couple kids and he's a little bit older than me. And having him on board for the book was actually like fantastic for me. Because not a lot of people know this, but these kids are actually a little bit older than I would have been in 1999. I was born in 1987, so I would have been, you know, 12. And these kids are 14-ish. So they're a little bit older than me. And like, I don't have a very crystal clear memory of like fashion and necessarily what bands were big at the time. Like that clarity starts coming for me about 2000, 2001. And having somebody who was more probably an adult at that point, it's just there to sort of anchor me and to be additive and to be like a really great collaborator and honestly save my ass. it was just fantastic. And because Nanad's in Serbia and because I'm sort of the face of the book, he really doesn't get a ton of, you know, the credit. And that's completely unwarranted. He should be getting most of it. And I just like let people know that ahead of time. And Sean did such an amazing job on those letters. Like we had one conversation about what I was imagining and he just ran away with it. And like, so there's been so much praise about the lettering in the book and like just the little different stylistic choices and like just everything about the book works because like the team was like so on the same page and well-oiled and we had all together before in Grief. Like it really was a dream book. I got to make it with some of the best people in comics. And like, I know that sounds like a bunch of bullshit, but it's just the truth. Like, and the proof is in the pudding, right? Like people like the book.
Mm-hmm. I have to say one of the things I really liked about it was the fact that, you know, any other book would have been called H Street Kids, which it's called Dead End. And if you look at the very first thing you see when you open the book, it says H Street and it has Dead End underneath it. Now, of course, it has that on the cover of the first one as well. So I got a kick out of that because that has multiple meanings to me, which I really enjoyed. I love when something does that. It makes me think a little bit about that. You know, they happen to be on a dead end street, but they're also dead end kids.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the thing. Like, I am a big fan of titles that have double meanings. Like if you read through Grief, I think all but one of the 10 stories has the title on the last page. And that's something I sort of picked up from Alan Moore. When you read Watchmen, any issue of Watchmen, you read the issue and you get to the last page and on the last panel, it's always a black panel with some white text and it's a quote or a song lyric. And when you reread the issue with that lyric or quote in mind, it gives you a sort of second reading of the book. Like a really good example is issue 5 is Fearful Symmetry. It's the one where you sort of get a lot about Rorschach and stuff like that. But the sort of structural thing about the whole book is that it's symmetrical. Like from the middle of the book outward, everything is reflected of, you know, so page 1 reflects page 20 or 24, whatever it is, and so on and so forth. And then at the end of that, you've got a quote from William Blake's The Tiger, which is a very famous illuminated poem about this, you know, mighty tiger and, you know, who has like the wrath of God. But then there's this art that goes with it that shows this very pale, not scary, almost sad looking tiger. And like you get this weird juxtaposition. And if you know that art and you know that quote and you go back and you reread that issue of Watchmen, you see like we see Rorschach unmasked for the first time. And if you look at the coloring on Rorschach's face, it's very similar to the coloring on the lion, or the tiger rather, from the poem. And like, there's all these little ins and outs. And for me, a very small version of doing that is to put the title at the end of the story so that people can go back and read it and get that second meaning. You know, for Embrace, the story is obviously it ends with the father and the son hugging and just deciding to move forward. But it's also about each one of them sort of embracing who the other one is and deciding it's time to stop butting heads. So like, there's that double meaning there. With Dead End Kids, you know, you hit it right on the head. They live on a dead end street. It's very on the nose. But there are also these kids who sort of have broken lives. You know, they are dead end kids, and that's very much by design. Having the actual H Street in Dead End that's just more of a personal reference. I grew up on Herbert Street, which was a dead end, and with kids who came from many backgrounds and had lots of things going on, and a lot of those kids and their lives are, you know, source material for the kids you got in Dead End Kids. So like, there's just a whole bunch going on. I wanted that opening sequence to be very cinematic with a big reveal. I mean, I tried to get a lot done in those pages, and I think hopefully largely effective. Oh,
it was great. I mean, I'm so glad I had all three of them, because when I got done with the first one, I said, holy smoke, I said, I have to know what happens next. And so I got into the second one, and then I had to see the third one. And it just really is one of those great stories. There's something about the teenage years that is just a mystery to us. Even though we've gone through them, we still look back at them as some sort of a, it's hard to explain. We don't understand. We were not adults, but not children either. And there's that strange intersection of lives there. And it's always interesting to see how those kinds of things happen. I think your book did a really good job of talking about people in that stage of life. It was really good.
Well, that was kind of the point. Like, the book for me started with a question that I was wondering about, because like, I had a really garbage life, and so did the kids I grew up with. And I mentioned my cousin Tom, who is pretty much exactly the same age as me, grew up in the same place as me, had fairly similar circumstances, and he went one completely different direction than me. And then my foster brother Harry, also about the same age, you know, same general circumstances, he went in a similar but different direction than me. And it got me thinking. Like, it got me asking this question: do the things that happen to us, you know, at a young age determine who we become? Mm-hmm. And if it does, to what extent, how much control do we have over it? And the sort of thesis of the book is that the answer is yes and yes. Like, yes, mm-hmm. Yes, these things do affect you, but how much they affect you is at least to some extent a choice we make. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, circumstances are what they are, and not everybody can be better than the circumstances they're handed all the time. But I think that, you know, trying is a choice. You know, some people just accept it or continue to make the same mistake. And it's not really a judgment. It's just the way that – and honestly, like, my opinion on that is different than what the book ultimately answers the question as, which was important to me too. Like, I didn't want it to be preachy. I wanted it to be one side of things. I don't agree necessarily with what the book had to say. On some level I do, because I wrote it. Mm-hmm. But it was important to me that it didn't really reflect my opinion. I didn't want me to be projecting myself. I wanted it to broaden the conversation, or at least start the conversation a little bit. It's just writing kids is it's hard and it's easy. Like, I didn't try is what it amounts to. When I tried to do it, it came out badly. So I just did it and didn't try. And what happened was, it's just, I drew on like the way I speak and how I spoke as a kid and things I went through. Like, I think there's a little bit of a universal experience to being, you know, 13 or 14 year old, especially for people of a certain age. Like, I'm 32, and I think, you know, I'm sure kids still play outside and ride bikes and stuff, but there was a time before cell phones were widely available, and things were a little bit different when there weren't iPads, and video games are a little more sophisticated than they were and more time consuming. And I was just drawing on that because it's my experience. Like, I think a lot of people get like, oh, the past was so much better and things suck now. And you know what? One of the big things I wanted to say with this book was that nostalgia is bullshit. Like, it really is bullshit. Like, the idea of golden years, like, it's what that does like to sort of romanticize the past that way. It totally ignores like the traumatic shit that you went through during those years, and sort of like ignores like all this stuff you went through that you weren't prepared for. Like, you know, any kid whose parents were divorced, but you know, at any point in their life, that affected them. And then you're going to look back at when you were 10 and say those are the best years of your life. Or if you had a friend die in third grade, or a brother who's a drug addict, like obviously there are good years and bad years, but to say those were easier times or better times than you have now or in the future or in between, like it's a way we all sell ourselves short, and it's a bad way to look at it. Yeah. I mean, there's good and bad in every period of your life. Like, I do look back on the years I was growing up as some of the best years of my life because I was surrounded by great people, some of whom I'm still very good friends with. But that doesn't mean my mom didn't have drug problems, and it doesn't mean that there weren't, you know, there weren't floods in my town that like ruined our house and like all these other things. So, like, I think I'm in the middle of writing like a short essay to put in the trade paperback of Data and Kids, and this is sort of going to be the gist of it, what I'm saying right now. I'm still sort of forming these thoughts, but man, at the end of the day, like, I wanted Dead End Kids to be an unromantic and honest look at childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. I mean, it's really, really gripping stuff. I mean, once I got started, I could not put it down because there was just so many things happening. And the nice thing, too, it's very dramatic, but also significant things happen from issue to issue, which I really like. Sometimes there's a lot of drama, but nothing happens.
Yeah. But
yours is not like that. Yours, things, we could talk about what goes on in each issue, because everyone has something significant going on. And it's just, if you like that kind of story like I do, I like something like that. I like drama. I like characterization, but I also like something to happen. After a while, if there's all word balloons for page after page after page, I kind of go like, is something going to happen here? But with your book, I never had to worry about that. Things happened.
And yeah, yeah.
Really interesting.
One of the things that for me makes me drop a comic book really fast is there's a bad trend, and this, I don't want to pigeonhole Image because they're not responsible for it primarily, but a lot of Image books I've read that I haven't liked, the first issue is always set up. Like, the plot doesn't kick off, and like the inciting incident happens on page 20, and then issue 2 is the actual start of the story. And you know, that comes from like trying to model comics after film structure, I think. And because, you know, long form storytelling and whatnot, there are a lot of reasons. But for me, like in Dead End Kids, and I'm not even sure that I didn't fail at this, but one of the goals was to get the story going and introduce the characters and make you give a shit about them. Like, I mean, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but it's sort of the premise of the book, too. On page 2, we find Ben dead floating under the pond of the lake. And then, like, that was a ballsy move on my part, like, you know, not even tooting my own horn, like, just to have a dead character that no one knows anything about on page 2, like, and asking a reader to care about that is a big ask. And like, what that did was put me in a place where I had to work really hard in the pages after it, which are a flashback, to make you give a shit about these four kids, and then how they react to Ben's death, and then get the story going, all in 20 pages. So like, it's, first issues are tough. They're really tough. Mm-hmm. And middle issues are tough, and endings I think are a little bit easier, but you know, who knows?
I think just the opposite. I think endings, there are a lot of, how should we say, miniseries. They start well, they go great, and you get to the end, blah. And I'm like, oh man, that could have ended so much better. See, your end I thought was really interesting. The end to Dead End Kids was really good. I mean, I did not expect that. That's part. If I can tell what's going to happen, I'm usually bored. But I was not bored with your book because I just sat there and went, I couldn't believe when we got to the end what happened. So I like that. See, I love it when I'm surprised. I really do.
And Andy gave me a piece of advice on writing. I don't know if he gave it to me directly, or maybe I heard him say it. But he told me, and I generally subscribe to this, that the best endings of books are the ones that take it a step further. Like, how to explain that? Like, they're sort of like, we know the sort of cadence of a lot of stories. We consume a lot of media these days. And then like, the story that takes it to the next scene, like what you know, then that's the unexpected thing. Cause like what happens next? And like, that's literally the text on the page at the end of the book, like what happened next. And like, that's, you know, very much on purpose because it's a little inside joke to myself. But also like, you know, I think I worked really hard to structure the book and the character arcs in such a way that while what happened before the black page at the end was surprising, it was built in and made sense. And then you get this sort of epilogue after the black page of what happens next. And that's sort of like this book's a coming of age story in yeah, the vein of Stand By Me. That was the big comparison I used. Stand By Me meets the Hardy Boys. And then at the end of most coming of age stories, specifically Stand By Me, sort of the story ends and you find out, you know, these kids, you know, they grew up and grew apart and they moved away and one of them ends up getting stabbed in the neck at a McDonald's and all this other stuff. But like, it's very much a trope in coming of age stories that the, you know, the kids have an adventure over the summer and then like you find out they all grew up and grew apart. And that really wasn't my experience. Like I got married in September and my best man was my best friend from childhood. Like, you know, like, and I still talk with my friends who live back east where I grew up and like, just I wanted to write a coming of age story that spoke to my experience of maintaining these friendships and like how, you know, you go through this stuff together as kids and, you know, then it doesn't, you know, those relationships don't last. And that just doesn't ring true to me necessarily. Like I definitely understand why some people don't stay friends and like that it's possible. But I saw a version of a coming of age story that you don't see very often. And I wanted to tell it and sort of set it in the 90s. And it really is just a big self-indulgent piece of crap. It's just all a temple to me.
Well, I don't know. See, to me, it was an experience I hadn't had. So it took me someplace I hadn't been. And to me, I really enjoyed that. I like to see experiences that I haven't already had. I mean, I've already had this experience that I've had. I'd like to see something else. Yeah. And that's why I like that book. I mean, I saw things in a different light than I had. And so for me, that was a real, I mean, heck, I used to always talk about the fact that Justice League, Gardner Fox taught me science in the early Justice League stories. And so I learned something from it. And I learned something different from your book in the sense that I saw some of these experiences people that didn't have my life have. And so I begin to understand a little bit more. And I just think, that's something we need more of today. I really do. So I hope people will get out and read this book. It's, again, it's Dead End Kids, and it's from Source Point Press, as well as Grief is also Source Point Press. So they're cutting out good stuff. This is really good because Source Point Press used to only do trades. And I like that they're going out and doing these kinds of books too. It's a little, something a little different.
Yeah, the market has been interesting for Source Point. They've been around since about 2012, 2013. I think they really got off the ground. So about 6 years. And they started off, doing sort of like really guerrilla style, you know, indie comics, you know, in the vein of like old school Caliber, you know, The Crow, Kabuki, the early Brian Bendis stuff, Goldfish, Torso, Jinx. And like their sort of market was they do 40 or 50 conventions a year and hand sell stuff. And they got really good at that. And by virtue of being with them for the last years, I'm also pretty good at that now too. But now as they've grown, like they've, you know, gotten in with Diamond and the single issues are more of a viable option. You know, it's hard to sell a single issue of a comic series at a convention, you know, because if you're not going to be back there for another year and there's three more issues and they're not out yet, like it's just a hard sell. So it's sort of evolved and changed and ebbed and flowed over the years. But they're in a really good spot. Dead End Kids came out in single issues, did really well at Diamond. Other books like Ogre and now Ogres is coming out currently, have done the same. Then trades, Dead End Kids will be out in trade in, I want to say March. I just submitted the solicit copy for the trade and I'm putting the trade together this week. The pre-order for that will probably come up in January. Grief is also getting a second printing. It sold out in July of this year. So I've got a handful of personal copies that are still available. But, you know, as bookstores, comic shops, no one else can get them, do you? So that'll probably be out in the early part of next year too. It'll probably get a resolicit in Diamond, probably January, February, and be out in March, April area. And then we'll, so it's just, you know, it's going to be an interesting 2020. I've got two trades coming out at the beginning of the year. I've got two miniseries in the pipeline, No Heroin and Dead End Kids 2 later in the year. And then some other stuff that I can't talk about.
That's a good thing when you can't talk about it, because that means it's coming.
Yeah, yeah. And some stuff that I wish was happening that I wish I could talk about, but that's not.
Keep your ear to the ground.
Yeah. And then one last thing, for anyone who is hearing this podcast very quickly, I think this is going to go up Sunday, you said. Next Monday through Friday, which is December 9th through the 13th, I think, I will be running a sort of sale on what's left of my stock for Grief and Dead End Kids on my web store. It's just frankogle.com/store. I have some first print sets of Dead End Kids left. I think there's four of those left. They've been so hard to come by, and I sat on these for a while so I could make sure they got to people who wanted them. I've got some reader sets, which are sort of a mix of first and second printings. There's a couple of variants thrown in to build out those reader sets, so those are kind of fun. I've got a bunch of variants that are going to be priced pretty cheaply for what we were charging earlier this year. If you want to check out Dead End Kids or Grief, this is probably going to be the last opportunity to check them out in their first printing forms or in single issue form. If you want to treat yourself to something nice for the holidays, just check out the store, see what you get.
Or give these to people who may not have read them yet, because they're really good stories on these things and good characters and stuff too. So you said it's at your website these will be available?
Yeah, I'm still sort of figuring out the logistics, but essentially sometime Monday morning, December 9th, they'll go live, and it's just frankogle.com/store. If you go to the main website, there's a link up in the top in the navigation. There'll be different packages. Pretty sure that I'm going to put free shipping on orders of $50 or over. If you're a variant person, it shouldn't be hard to get up to the $50.
Cool. Well, it's good stuff. I have to say, I got them in my hands right now, and I'm glad I got them, because they are really great reading and stuff if you're like me, you haven't experienced this, it's going to be a new experience for you. And so I always appreciate that, and I really enjoy that. Now, if people want to keep up with what you're doing and stuff like on, obviously you've got the website. Are you on social media too?
Yeah. I do primarily for comics. I do Instagram. I really like Instagram as a social media. I'm a very visual person, and I think, you know, getting to look at things rather than read them is a plus. So that's where I do most of my comics sort of stuff. I'm on Twitter. I'm using it more than I used to. I still think it's a pretty cesspool kind of place, but as my sort of fan base has grown and I've connected with more creators and stuff, it's a little more enjoyable. So I've been on there a lot more. And I'm on Facebook. I'm honestly like not a very picky person. I don't have a fan page. I have like a personal profile. If you like my work and you want to connect and you want to talk about the work or anything, people can shoot me the friend request. Like, I don't mind, as long as people are polite and respectful and not Nazis. If you want to take it a step back further and just do Instagram or Twitter, it's just, you know, at Frank Gogol, FrankGogol, one word. One more thing I want to add, for the people who are going to hear this in the more immediate couple of weeks leading up to, you know, Christmas and the holidays. I write my books so people can read them. And if you are strapped for cash and it's the holidays and you got to prioritize presents and you really want to check out the work, shoot me a DM. I'll send you the PDFs. If you want to read it, check it out. Like, it's, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's just like, I don't know. Like, it, I want people to read it more than I want their money, like a lot more. And like, if it helps, like last year at Christmas time, I was in Paris, for Christmas last year with my family, which was a really nice special trip. I got engaged. It was really great. I tweeted out, you know, that anyone who wanted it, and who was like alone at the holidays or whatever, who wanted to read Grief and, you know, get a little hope in their lives or whatever, could hit me up and I would send them the PDF as soon as I could. And I had like more than 100 people hit me up. And like,
wow.
And well, all right. So when you give away stuff for free, like I don't not expect people to come for it. But what really sort of blew my mind was that people afterwards, and like more than half, like conservatively more than half, like reached back out to say they read it and that they liked it. And like were asking about other things that I was writing and stuff like that. So like, I don't know. I believe in like being a good fucking person. Like it's just that simple. Like if me giving you my book that's digital and doesn't cost me anything but a couple seconds of my time makes your life a little bit better, like that's a really easy decision to make. So yeah, if anyone's strapped for cash, wants to check the books out, hit me up. I'll send you the PDFs. We can talk. We can make it happen.
Super cool. Because, you know, when I talk to people, because I don't want to incur expenses. If I didn't already have your books, I would have asked you to send me PDFs, because I don't want to incur expenses on you. People have to send me paper copies and all that stuff. I'd rather just get the PDF, which is free as far as that goes. Well, but on the other hand, you know, some people, when they get the PDFs and they really like it, they'll go out and buy the they'll find the paper copies.
Sure. I was actually just tonight on my walk home, I was listening to the Sketched podcast, which is, you know, definitely top two or three podcasts for me. Joshua Williamson was on, who writes Flash at DC and does Nailbiter. And he was talking about when Image put the first issue of Nailbiter on Comixology Unlimited, like they almost immediately saw a big bump in trade sales, right? So like, because people could check the book out for free and sample it for free, they, you know, were able to find out that they loved it, and then they bought the books. Like, and like, that is definitely an added benefit of me giving my book away for free. It's not why I do it, but if people want to check out Grief and love Grief and then want to buy a copy of Grief, that's a win-win for everybody. Like, I mean, there's the thing, and like I said, like I don't care about dollars. Like if I could give everything in physical form away for free, I probably would, but that just, I would be so far in debt and no one would publish me. So there's a reason to not do it.
Well, I have to tell you a real quick story. I was talking with a guy from the UK, and he was telling me that somebody had gotten a hold of a digital copy and they put it out on, I used to know the term for this, but they put it out somewhere. People put it down. Yeah. They put it out on a torrent. And he was so mad at first, but then all of a sudden, people, when they looked at it on the torrent, they really liked it, so they went out and bought physical copies of it. So he actually was there thanking people who put it out in the torrent, because it got him more sales as a result of it. I don't think that happens every time, but that happened with him. And he was really, you know, pleased that when people read the content, they loved the content so much, they went out and got the copy. And I think if people get a hold of the digital copies of yours, I think they're going to be after good copies to keep.
That would be great. Like, and if they don't, that's fine too. Like, it's the piracy conversation is very interesting. It's actually been sort of like a very hot topic the last couple of weeks. And I definitely have opinions about it, but at the end of the day, like I do believe that people who pirate comics were probably never going to buy the comics to begin with. Like if they weren't, you know, if they weren't available digitally, they probably just wouldn't read them, or they'd read something else. That's just my take on it. It's not necessarily the right one. I'm not advocating piracy by any means, but my view is not necessarily that everyone who pirates a book is a lost sale. But the example you just gave is a pretty good one about how people who pirate could become fans. Like, you know, think of how much product Netflix puts out for like such a little amount of money. Like if you think it's $10 a month, right? But it's literally hundreds of thousands of hours of content. So it basically is free. They actually probably lose money on a single subscription. And some math probably justifies that.
Well, maybe we'll be lucky and these will end up on Netflix at some point. Wouldn't that be something?
Well, yeah, without saying too much about it, there definitely were a couple of pitch meetings, informal and semi-formal, throughout the year, a couple at New York Comic Con and some when I was in LA the following weekend. Conversations have been even as high as a Sony exec.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, I don't care about making TV or movies. Like if it happens, great. If I can make some money off of it, make some more comics with that money, that's awesome. But it's not why I'm doing it. But you know, at the end of the day, like it's an opportunity for me to make more comics. But until the ink is dry on the contract, nothing is official. Nothing is happening. But it is cool to say that, and you know, this is my first miniseries. This is my first comic that was released in single issues. It got me the ability to pitch
some not insignificant studios. I got to submit work to Marvel. I got to network with awesome people. I got to travel around the world a bunch. Not the world, the country. I could not have asked for a better couple of opening books between Grief and Dead End Kids. Like, they've just been so wonderful to me. They have. They're the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, Grief came out in 2017, almost 3 years ago at this point. And just last month, or a month and a half ago now, I was in Baltimore at Baltimore Comic Con at the Ringo's because it was nominated for a Ringo. Like,
right.
It just keeps getting – just keeps making my life better. I'm so happy that it's resonating with people. And, like, awards are cool, but the best – like, usually – this will be the last thing I say, I think. I'll go to a con and I'll sell, you know, somewhere between like 0 and 60 copies of Grief. Like, that's the range. The most I've ever sold was about 70. And I've had shows where I've sold none because they were bad shows. But I generally sell about 20 or 30. And usually by Wednesday of the next week, you know, after I get home on Sunday, I'll get like a Twitter message or a Facebook friend request from somebody who bought the book. And they send me these sweet notes about how much they love the book and which stories they looked at. And that has literally happened after every single convention. I've done about 30, 35 conventions since I started 2 years ago. And I've got screenshots of these, and there's at least 40 messages in this folder of screenshots. Like, it's just, and Dead End Kids has been sort of the same kind of revelation, but for different people. Like Grief has not necessarily done well with male readers. It definitely sells to everybody in some way or form, but women really like Grief a lot, and that definitely breaks that way. But Dead End Kids, like, for being like an emotional drama driven story, like, I've had lots of men 18 to 60 honestly, like, tell me about how much they've loved the book. And like, just between these two books, like, I feel like I've really hit a mark with a lot of different kinds of readers, and just the appreciation runs so deep. And like, I am honestly super, super grateful to anyone who takes any of their hard-earned money and or time or effort or vacation or whatever to check out my book, track my book down, read it, tell me about it. Like, I mean, that every one of those things is fuel on the fire to make the next one and make it better.
I think you're only getting started, Frank, because I think I've read them and I love them, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. So it's just good stuff, Frank. And man, I like I said, I think we just scratched the surface of the kind of good things you're going to do. So I'm going to be buying your books. I see your name on it. I'm going to get it because you've got a fan in me for sure, and it's really good stuff. So I just wish you more and more success as you go along, because you have got so many good stories to tell, I think, and it's going to be, for all of us out here, we just can't wait to see it.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And thank you for having me on and for staying up so late to do it. It means the world.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man of flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
I hope you're enjoying a wonderful holiday season, and that you'll be back next week when I'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.